so happy to be here. Can everybody hear me? Nobody's answering? Yes, okay, good. And thanks to the organizations that invited me, VIEW and MoMA and the Master, whatever it is. And especially want to thank Magda and Louisa for their, everybody for their warm hospitality, especially Magda and Louisa. My talk is entitled Unwar, an aesthetic sketch, it's supposed to be. I don't know why it says project, but that must have been another iteration of the talk. So it's Unwar, an aesthetic sketch. Attempts to abolish war, not a particular war, but war as a social institution, are often dismissed as wild fantasies, far removed from the realm of real politics. War, we are told, is inevitable. Humans are territorial and predatory beings. Besides, there has always been war. Who can forget the opening pages of Kurt Vonnegut's Slaughterhouse-Five, wherein the narrator says he's writing an anti-war novel, and his interlocutor replies, "You know what I say to people when I hear they're writing anti-war books? I say, why don't you write an anti-glacier book instead?" What he meant, of course, the narrator explains, was that there would always be wars, that they were as easy to stop as glaciers. Of course, that was before global warming. Still, Krzysztof Fedichko fearlessly pursues perpetual peace in an ongoing aesthetic project titled The Arc de Triomphe, World Institute for the Abolition of War, and in a book, The Abolition of War, which documents, contextualizes, and theorizes the project. Introduced in Harvard Design Magazine in 2010, Arc de Triomphe is a proposal to attach a transparent, scaffold-like structure to the Arc de Triomphe in Paris. Traditional historical monuments, like the Parisian Arc, embody what Friedrich Nietzsche called monumental history, and Walter Benjamin famously denounced as the history of the victors, the past narrated as a progression of eternally great moments. Therefore, all traditional monuments, whether or not they overtly commemorate war, can be considered war memorials. Fedichko has long treated them as such in public projections that animate and destabilize monumental structures. For example, the homeless projection, San Diego Museum of Man projection, both realized in the US in the 1980s. The projections infiltrate buildings and sculptures with images that awaken memories of those who are defeated in the conflicts that produce social space. The neoclassical Arc de Triomphe, however, seen an object of Fedichko's new activity, is not only an explicit war memorial, a permanent insult to the vanquished by the victor, but an especially hyperbolic example of the genre. Until 1982, the Arc de Triomphe was the largest triumphal arch in the world, and its immensity, coupled with its triumphalist patriotic messages, made it the standard for modern public monuments. Commissioned in 1806, completed in 1836, modeled on the Roman Arch of Titus, the Arc glorifies revolutionary and Napoleonic conquests. For many years, it served as the rallying point of French troops parading after successful military campaigns. As the linchpin of the city's sequence of monuments and grand thoroughfares known as the historical axis, the Arc now occupies a central place in both Paris and the European Union. Beneath its vault lies the tomb of the unknown soldier from World War I, the war to end all wars, installed on Armistice Day in 1920, accompanied by the first eternal flame lit in Europe since the 4th century, and by a typically nationalistic inscription, "Here lies a French soldier who died for the fatherland, 1914 to 1918. The Ark is adorned with 30 shields inscribed with the names of 96 revolutionary and Napoleonic military victories, allegorical and historical friezes, an engraved list of French victories, an engraved list of 660 soldiers and generals who fought in French victories, and four enormous sculptural reliefs, including, most strikingly, François Rude's Bellicose La Marseillaise, featuring a wild-eyed winged victory wearing a helmet crowned by furies. The chronological order of the reliefs, advancing from departure to triumph to resistance to peace, suggests that war can produce peace. The Didjko approaches the Arc de Triomphe not only as a symbol, but also as a symptom of what he calls our culture of war. The motivation to fight and die in war, he writes, is perpetuated by a culture of war that manifests itself through uniforms, war games, parades, military decorations, and war memorials, including statues and shrines, triumphal arches, cenotaphs, victory columns, and other commemorations of the dead, the creation of war art and military art, martial music, and war museums, and the popular fascination with weapons, war toys, violent video and computer games, battle reenactments, collectibles, and military history and literature. And that's the end of the Vidichko quote. These undisguised expressions of warlike culture that Vidichko lists are only the tip of the iceberg, however. For as Virginia Woolf argued in Three Guineas, her feminist anti-war essay of 1938, the culture of war takes more insidious and therefore more dangerous forms. It's perpetuated, for instance, in the customs of the most esteemed professions of men. Distinctions of dress that indicate rank, or titles placed before or letters after names, both of which establish superiority and arouse competition, encouraging a warlike disposition, grandiose, vain, egoistic, possessive, combative. Enclosed within Vidichko's new structure, the World Institute for the Abolition of War, the Arc de Triomphe undergoes a Brechtian transformation into an extraordinary object. Remaining fully visible, but appearing isolated and entrapped, it metamorphoses into a gigantic specimen, as Vidichko describes it, or even a pathogen, which produces war as collective madness. World Institute's objective is to detoxify the Arc, combining commemorative, research, educational, and proactive functions. It allows the public, as well as scholars from a variety of disciplines, to examine the memorial from new viewpoints. The Institute also houses a wide array of activities devoted to peacemaking, or what Vidichko calls unwar, a term he prefers to peace. Peace, after all, has long coexisted with preparedness for war. According to the American philosopher William James, writing in the first decade of the 20th century, peace in military mouths today is a synonym for war expected. The word has become a pure provocative, and no government wishing peace sincerely should allow it ever to be printed in a newspaper. Every up-to-date dictionary should say that peace and war mean the same thing, now in passé, now in actu. It may even be reasonably said that the intensely sharp preparation for war by the nations is the real war, permanent, unceasing, and that the battles are only a sort of public verification of the mastery gained during the peace interval. Unwar, by contrast with peace, implies disarmament, a process of undoing war, which, as we shall see, Vidichko understands not only as military preparedness and combat, but also as an individual and collective state of mind. Vidichko's plan for a project to disarm the Ark incorporates meticulous technical drawings meant for actual use into an imaginative anticipation of a building and a social condition that may come to be. Renderings of the proposed institute present a system of ramps, elevators, horizontally moving walkways, and vertically moving viewing platforms that intersect along the outside and through the inside of the Ark. I'm just showing you a few of his renderings. The circulation system allows visitors to study the Ark's iconography and diagnose the war pathologies that war culture tries to repress. For instance, when standing on a platform to view at eye level the female representation of victory at the top of Rude's La Marseillaise, one can detect just how crazed she is. External and internal plasma screens and pixel boards installed throughout the scaffolding display programs related to the Institute's work and encourage visitors to stop to join discussions. Parallel to the main frieze of the Ark is a continuous strip of media display panels enumerating all recorded wars, campaigns, battles, and military assaults on civilians, and listing direct and indirect human casualties. Similarly, parallel to each relief honoring a Napoleonic battle stands a list of killed and wounded soldiers, prisoners of war, and civilians. Currently, there are several different designs for the World Institute. Likewise, the Institute's program is provisional. Vidichko foresees the division of the structure's top floors into four informational zones, each containing audiovisual, interactive, telepresence, and immersive displays and environments. The zones, suggests the artist, might be devoted to providing information about past and present peace-building efforts, the disarmament process, the present state of world armament, multidisciplinary theoretical discourses in peace-related fields, past and present, and cultural, artistic, and pedagogical projects that have contributed to the discourse of war resistance. Vidichko's program also provides for a world situation map to be located in the area above the roof of the Ark in the central horizontal section of the upper level of the structure, displaying the changing global dynamics of wars, conflicts, post-war, post-conflict, and peace zones. The map hangs over a large hall devoted to a discursive forum for the abolition of war, a highly mediatized space that hosts special events and global conferences. The area surrounding the discursive forum contains facilities for a cross-disciplinary center for global peace projects, which develops and implements practical programs to abolish war. World Institute for the Abolition of War aims to render the Arc de Triomphe inoperative in promoting war. But, says Vidichko, it is not enough to disarm the culture of war. Unwar projects must also disarm the individual. Indeed, one of the premises of World Institute is that abolishing war is an individual responsibility. Vidichko's call for individual responsibility arises not from moralism, but from the conviction that we are each accountable for war, because as psychoanalysis teaches us, war is hidden in our unconscious minds. We are ourselves inner war memorials, the artist writes, unwittingly echoing Gertrude Stein, who in 1947 observed that while there is certainly war outside, there is also war inside. What is there inside, in one, that makes one know all about war? Stein asked. In response, Vidichko makes research into the psychoanalytic dimensions of war an indispensable part of his project's agenda. War, of course, is above all a collective phenomenon, so the notion that we are inner war memorials raises the vexed question of the relationship between war inside and war outside, between, that is, the psychical and the social realms. Is violence installed in us from within or from without? In an essay devoted to the topic of the location of violence, Jacqueline Rose poses the question this way: where does the misery come from? Rose examines two conventional answers to the question. One claims that violence is imposed on the individual psyche by a strictly external social world that is itself untouched by psychic processes. The other answer asserts that a strictly internal psychical world causes social violence. Rose observes that these two seemingly opposing positions share a common structure, one that we might note is warlike. Each pits inside and outside against each other in deadly combat. Consequently, they evade the radical ambiguity of the inside-outside psychical-social relationship. To begin with, the psychoanalytic subject itself is social, which is to say that we are formed through relationships, and that the emergence of the subject is one and the same with the entry into the social field, so that subjectivity exceeds the level of the individual. Therefore, there can be no bright line, no rigid polarity between internal and external worlds. In addition, psychoanalytic theory has investigated the connection between individual and social subjectivity, particularly in its study of what's called the group mind. Psychoanalytically speaking, then, the idea that war exists inside each of us does not mean that an external culture of war imposes war on our minds, although this is no doubt true. Neither does it mean that the state forces us to make war, though this is also true. Rather, it means that unconscious aggressivity, a tendency towards destructive, hostile attitudes and behavior, a tendency springing from the individual's formative relationships, abides in human subjects, persisting throughout our lives, and playing a significant role in war outside. For this reason, each individual is responsible for war in the sense of being its agent, and in an ethical universe, each individual is responsible for war in the sense of being accountable for abolishing it. So the next section of my talk is called Responsibility. Psychoanalytic literature offers many ideas about the psychic dimensions of the war phenomenon. In 1915, for example, during World War I, we find Freud struggling to understand the connection between internal and external violence, expressing shock at the extreme cruelty of the war and the participating nation's lack of respect for laws of war. Freud speculated that war depends on a regression to infantile barbarism. Regression, he writes, is possible because in the development of the human mind, earlier stages persist alongside later ones. succession also involves coexistence. Normally, the capacity for barbarous deeds is held in check by the community and the state, which forbid wrongdoing. Freud hypothesized that the state does so not because it desires to abolish wrongdoing, but because it desires to monopolize it. In times of war, however, the state sanctions rather than prohibits barbarism. As far as I'm aware, the most thoroughly elaborated psychoanalytic theory of war was drafted in the 1960s by the Italian psychoanalyst Franco Fornari. He was president of the Italian Psychoanalytic Society, a member of Psychoanalysts Against Nuclear War, and the figure who introduced in Italy the ideas of Melanie Klein. In 1964, Fornari published a book titled The Psychoanalysis of Nuclear War, following it 2 years later with The Psychoanalysis of War, a book that has greatly influenced Vidichko. Fornari wanted to return war to the unconscious of the individual subject while, like Freud, avoiding reductive approaches to the inside-outside relationship. Fornari reassured his readers that psychoanalytic exploration is not a matter of a conflict between the traditionally recognized external causes of war, economic, demographic, political, ideological, etc., and its unrecognized internal causes, but rather of a shift of emphasis from the former to the latter. Fornari also said that the mobilization of the psychological factors of war requires the intervention of specific historical realities. Yet at the same time, he insisted that investigations into social phenomena like war that separate social facts from the concrete individuals who form the society provide a pseudo-scientific pretext for renouncing responsibility. In Fornari's theory, war mobilizes unconscious anxieties and conflicts that, as Melanie Klein taught, arise from the major role played by aggression in infantile mental life. For Klein, the infant's rudimentary ego experiences conflict between loving and destructive impulses. The conflict is aroused by and experienced in relation to external objects, such as the mother's breast, which, as the infant's first love object, stands for the principle of the outside world. Terrified by its internal destructiveness, which it believes can destroy the love object, the infant rids itself of the terror by means of the unconscious mechanisms of splitting and projection. Splitting the external world into good and bad objects, the infant projects its own destructiveness into the bad ones, which it perceives as persecutory and destructive of the love object. Fornari argued that the individual subject's projection of its internal terror, which he calls the internal terrifier, onto external enemies operates in war. Only in adult life, the love object that needs protection is a group or nation. Projection motivated by terror and love allows us to express aggressiveness without guilt. As a result, war defends people against anxieties about internal enemies by finding real enemies to kill. But, said Fornari, with the advent of the nuclear situation, war enters a state of crisis. It ceases to operate as a defense because nuclear war destroys the love object along with the enemy. With regard to responsibility, the most important part of Fornari's theory is his idea that the individual subject gets rid of its violence, which is prohibited by law, by investing or alienating it in the state, which monopolizes violence. Fornari wanted to return war to the subject in order to rouse individuals from their alienation in the state, and thereby motivate them to take responsibility for war. In a passage that Vodichko spotlights in his book, The Abolition of War, Fornari wrote, "It is we ourselves who desire war, and the alienation of our aggressiveness into the state serves us simply to be able to say that it is not we who desire war, but that the state forces us to make war. In this manner, we convince ourselves that the state is responsible for war in order to not feel responsible for it ourselves. To escape from our alienation in the state, therefore, means to be personally responsible for war, just as we feel personally responsible for inter-individual crimes." Taking responsibility for abolishing war begins then with taking responsibility for war, which is one and the same act as taking responsibility for the unconscious. And taking responsibility for the unconscious means tolerating what Freud taught us, that in our unconscious, as Mignon Nixon has remarked, we are very bad. Because the alternative to tolerating badness is self-deception, to take responsibility for the unconscious is to adopt what has been called a courageously disillusioned Freudian politics, one that acknowledges what is most disillusioning about the human subject. "It is a central tenet of psychoanalysis," writes Jacqueline Rose, "that if we can tolerate what is most disorienting, disillusioning about our own unconscious, we are less likely to act on it, less inclined to strike out in a desperate attempt to assign the horrors of the world to someone or somewhere else. It is not the aggressive impulse that is dangerous, but the ruthlessness of our attempts to be rid of it." In an uncharacteristic moment, Vodichko promises that unwar projects will eventually turn our formerly bloody, self-destructive minds into a thing of the past and make our souls war-free. In saying this, he turns away from the psychoanalytic principles he otherwise espouses. For in reality, as Freud stressed, there is no such thing as eradicating psychic violence. Recognizing this psychic fact is the psychoanalytic stand. Naive idealism, the charge frequently leveled at those who want to abolish war, inheres not in working for a world without war, but rather in failing to face the difficulty of the goal, a difficulty that arises because opposition to abolishing war comes not only from others, but also has its roots in ourselves. Yet today, in an era of perpetual war and sexualized torture, intellectuals on the left often refuse responsibility for the unconscious, expressing the belief that psychoanalytic ideas about subjectivity are a distraction from politics. At this point, you may be worried that these reflections on individual responsibility will divert attention for the need for collective action. But for those whose anti-war politics is courageously disillusioned, the reverse has been the case. Precisely because we are warlike, they have argued, a less violent world requires the establishment of new social institutions and, in particular, international institutions. Consider to begin with Immanuel Kant's 1795 essay, Perpetual Peace, a Philosophical Sketch, one of the earliest modern proposals for an international peacemaking institution. Kant believed that the warlike inclination of those in power, the savagery of European and American states, is integral to human nature. Quote, "A state of peace among men living together is not the same as the state of nature, which is rather a state of war." what Kant elsewhere called radical evil, a wickedness of the human heart that is innate in the sense that it cannot be gotten rid of, and that is displayed on the level of the state in war. Radical evil, said Kant, makes peace difficult. And thus he concluded, the state of peace must be formally instituted. Kant's reasoning about the relationship between evil and social institutions applies equally if we view war psychoanalytically. Because of our ineradicable badness, our unconscious aggressivity, unwar must be formally instituted. Fornari said as much, quote, "The purpose of the psychoanalytic disclosure of the individual responsibility for war is to prepare the ground for new social institutions which would allow the individual concretely to express his responsibility on the politico-social level. If it is I who am responsible, it is I who must make amends. But if I must make amends, I must have concrete political instruments through which my reparative wishes may be concretely expressed." Believing that responsibility for unconscious wishes can become a social force, Fornari proposed one such reparative political institute, which he named the Omega Institution, to which we shall return. So the next part of the talk is called cosmopolitics. In designing World Institute for the Abolition of War, Krzysztof Wojtyszko becomes heir to the modern legacy of international peacemaking, placing his work within the field of cosmopolitan politics, or as it's sometimes called, cosmopolitics. Modern cosmopolitanism, an embattled term going back to the 18th century, encompasses a variety of moral and political views and is currently the object of vigorous debates. I use it here to refer to a global political consciousness that, though not necessarily post-nationalist, responds to the suffering of those who live beyond its own geographic and cultural borders and is adversarial in relation to global patriarchy and capitalist cosmopolitanism, and that's what Marx called exploitation on a world scale through a global mode of production. Equally contentious is cosmopolitan's correlative term, universalism. By contrast with depoliticizing, generalizing universalisms that cast differences and particularity into privacy and constitute one aspect of Enlightenment thought, universalism can also name a practice dedicated to extending the demand for justice and equality, which was another facet of the Enlightenment. This demand for justice requires, in Etienne Balibar's words, a universal right to politics, a right, that is, to question the social order. Joan Kopchak advocates this second kind of Enlightenment universalism in a superb essay on radical evil. The Kantian universal, Kopchak writes, is neither an underlying principle that informs individual beings, nor a superior instance that subsumes our particularity. It is rather the focal point of our actions. Focused on perpetual peace, Kant believed that the only rational way to bring it about was to establish an international state. Realizing, however, that at the time he was writing, such a state was not the will of nations, he proposed what he called a negative substitute, a federation of nations that would create a system of international law based on principles of right. Franco Fornari also believed in a single world government, and like Kant, though for different reasons, envisioned obstacles to its formation. Fornari, however, emphatically rejected Kant's substitute, a union of states, an organization like the United Nations, in which each member nation is above all jealous of preserving its own sovereignty. World government, Fornari insisted, presupposes the abolition of state sovereignty. But who will abolish it? Arguing that the abolition of sovereignty from above by international agreements between nations would arouse persecution and castration anxieties that lead to heightened vindictiveness, Fornari maintained that state sovereignty must first be abolished from below, when individual citizens take back the violence they have alienated in the state. In so doing, individuals do not themselves become violent or exonerate the state's violence, but rather they take responsibility for war by withdrawing their consent to state violence, protesting against it. Returning to the subject, then, is the starting point for the sovereign state to evolve toward the non-sovereign state, one subject to the same laws as its citizens. Returning to the subject is also the foundation of Fornari's Omega Institution, a judicial institution operating on a national level that Fornari proposed might inaugurate the evolution to non-sovereignty by establishing laws prohibiting the nation's aggression against other groups and instituting penalties for the exportation of violence. The Omega Institution would detoxify national cultures and group identities and pave the way to world government. Vidichko's World Institute for the Abolition of War diverges from the more classical paradigms of international peacemaking because, unlike Kant's and Fornari's proposals, it is not grounded in the model of the nation-state at all. Instead, it stresses multilateral, non-governmental alliances such as the Discursive Forum for the Abolition of War and the Cross-Disciplinary Center for Global Peace Projects. Neither does World Institute make reference to world government. Rather, World Institute helps construct a new cosmopolitics, one that is responsive to Jacques Derrida's call to cultivate the spirit of the cosmopolitan tradition by questioning its limits and adjusting it to our own time. For Derrida, this means, among other things, recognizing that justice is not fully exercised within the framework of the nation state or the boundaries of law, that the law cannot encompass ethical life. While Vidichko, like Derrida, no doubt supports international law, World Institute is not a lawmaking or judicial institution, but rather a public and a cultural one. Public, not in the sense of state-related or open to a pre-existing audience, but public because it cultivates a public sphere of critical speech and democratic agonistic discourse. Perhaps the very debate about war might help bring about unwar, for as Chantal Mouffe writes, the novelty of democratic politics is not the overcoming of the us-them distinction, which is an impossibility, but the different way in which the distinction is established. The aim of democratic politics is to construct the them in such a way that it is no longer perceived as an enemy to be destroyed, but as an adversary, that is, somebody whose ideas we combat, but whose right to defend those ideas we do not put into question. World Institute, unlike previous peacemaking proposals, aims to dismantle the culture of war and institute a new transnational unwar culture. It thus challenges the oft-expressed notion that emotional ties, identifications, and shared responsibilities can only be forged on local and national scales. Bruce Robbins, he's a scholar of cosmopolitanism, notes that though the concept of culture emerged historically in close connection with nationalism, it does not belong inevitably or definitively on the side of nation, inheritance, or locality. The reason is that while throughout most of human history, both habitual knowledge of others and habitual opportunities to affect others' lives were very limited in space, social organizations and communication technologies have now expanded, and along with them, possibilities for international common cultures and modes of belonging. Fujitsuko mobilizes sophisticated communication and information technologies to realize one such possibility, to bring about an unwar instance of what Robbins calls global feeling. World Institute, therefore, exemplifies a newer cosmopolitan, one that reconsiders the virtues of cosmopolitanism's universalist impulse and, like the Omega Institution, makes it a priority to oppose the military aggression of one's own country, especially that of the United States. In the preface to Perpetual Peace, Kant remarks on the practical politician's condescending attitude toward political theorists. The worldly wise statesman, he writes, believes that the theorist is a mere academic who cannot endanger the state. It thus follows, Kant concludes, that if the practical politician is to be consistent, he must not claim, in the event of a dispute with the theorist, to scent any danger to the state in the opinions which the theorist has randomly uttered in public. By this saving clause, the author of this essay, Kant, will consider himself expressly safeguarded in correct and proper style against all malicious interpretation. Kant casts himself as a hopeless idealist, detached from practical matters, trading in fantasies, the role frequently assigned to those who assume responsibility for abolishing war. Kant's preface is ironic, though, because Kant actually rejected the notion that historical hopes must never be entertained unless we see clear signs that humanity is on the brink of fulfilling them. World Institute for the Abolition of War makes clear that the same is true of Fujitsuko, who, in a time of perpetual war, allows the historical hope of unwar to appear, establishing it as a reality. Thank you.